You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of July 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from a Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's agenda with Monocle's Thomas Lewis. What do you have for us, Tom?
Well, the deadline in Egypt looms as the standoff between the army and Mohamed Morsi continue. We'll have a look at what's likely to happen at 4 p.m. London time when the deadline reaches its head.
Also on the programme... the strains of the Olympic hymn there that will surely be on the minds of the delegations vying to host the 2020 Summer Olympic Games. We'll hear from our correspondents in the candidate cities, Tokyo, Madrid and Istanbul, ahead of a crucial day of presentations.
And we'll be raising a glass to the Finnish wine importer who's managed to impress Finland's notoriously picky regulator of the country's drinking habits.
Usually the problems come when people look at the colour or when people think that this is a wine you should just enjoy on its own when it's hot outside. That's not really the case. You got to be more open-minded than that, as usual with wine, and realize that these wines are excellent.
All that plus we'll throw in some great music as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
Phil, are you prepared to put your money behind one of the candidate cities?
I am.
Really?
I'm not going to tell you which one yet.
I see. But you're going to put it behind one.
I'll hear what our correspondents have to say and then maybe reassess.
Okay. Yeah. So sealed ballot for the moment. Okay. Well, that's Phil is not being drawn. So the tension is rising here. We'll be talking to our correspondents around the world in our first item. But first, of course, we will get the news. Paul Osborne's here.
Mohamed Morsi has insisted he is Egypt's legitimate ruler with just hours to go to the deadline imposed by the military. The armed forces are reportedly poised to depose Mr. Morsi unless he agrees to share power with his rivals. It's reported Egypt's constitution could be suspended and an interim ruling council imposed ahead of new elections. Mr. Morsi went on state TV late on Tuesday night, saying he would give his life to protect Egypt's constitution. But the crowds in Cairo's Tahrir Square say he must step down.
Enough. The Egyptian people are suffocating. Only God knows how upset we are. Morsi doesn't understand. He doesn't see. The entire Egyptian people hate you. They don't want you. Enough.
At least 16 people have been killed in an apparent U.S. drone strike in Pakistan. Most of those killed in the attack in North Waziristan are believed to have been fighters from the militant Haqqani network. If confirmed, it will be the second drone strike inside Pakistan since the new Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif demanded an end to the attacks. Bolivia is condemning a huge lie, which it says forced a plane carrying the country's president to be diverted. It's reported France and Portugal refused to allow Evo Morales' plane to pass through their airspace after reports the US whistleblower Edward Snowden was on board. Bolivia is one of more than 20 countries where Mr. Snowden has sought asylum. There have been protests outside the French embassy in La Paz. An earthquake in the Aceh province of Indonesia has killed at least 22 people and injured 200 more. Rescue workers are struggling to reach the worst affected areas because of landslides. The magnitude 6.1 quake struck the western tip of Sumatra. An extreme heat wave is continuing in western parts of the United States and Canada. In Palm Springs, in California, the temperature rose to 134 degrees Fahrenheit, or 56 degrees Celsius. Local authorities are trying to set up cool centers for people who don't have access to air-conditioned rooms. James Thompson is from Palm Springs City Hall.
We did receive an increased number of calls to the fire department and the paramedic squad due to the heat. We had about a 10% increase in calls to the paramedics for heat-related illnesses over the weekend, and those were all responded to. Our firefighters were very hot and very tired, but we did respond to all the calls and took care of all those needs of those folks.
Portugal's prime minister is facing a growing political crisis after the resignation of a second key minister. Foreign Minister Paulo Portas stood down the day after the finance minister Vitor Gaspar resigned, but the prime minister Pedro Passos Coelho has said he won't give up his country. Three former executives at the Japanese firm Olympus have been given suspended prison sentences over an accounting scandal. They admitted falsifying accounts to cover up losses of $1.7 billion. Olympus has also been fined $7 million over one of the biggest financial scandals ever seen in Japan. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Paul. It's 5 minutes past the hour here in London. We'll get a check of the latest world news headlines in about 25 minutes as well from now. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Now, it's the largest sporting event on the planet, and yes, every 4 years, one city has the honour of hosting the Summer Olympics. That city gets the prestige, the promise, and the multi-billion dollar price tag. And while Rio will host the 2016 Games, all eyes now are on which city will host 4 years later. Istanbul, Madrid, and Tokyo are the three finalists vying for the right to host the Games of the 32nd Modern Olympiad, and today could make or break their chances.
The three candidate cities will be making crucial presentations to the 100-plus members of the International Olympic Committee. The IOC members will vote in early September at a session in Buenos Aires in secret ballot for their choice. Well, to gauge the mood within the candidate cities, we spoke to our correspondents there. We'll kick things off in Tokyo.
I'm Fiona Wilson. I'm Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief. The bid team is now in Lausanne, ready for its presentation tomorrow. And this comes off the back of the report they got from the IOC Evaluation Commission, which followed on from the visit to Tokyo in March by the Commission. And the team said they were extremely pleased with the evaluation. It was a very positive report, and it really focused on exactly the subjects that Tokyo has been trying to promote. It talked about the fact that Tokyo would make a very well-organised, safe Games. It said it liked the compact city centre nature of the plan. Tokyo's plan is basically to have everything within an 8-kilometre radius so that nobody has to travel for more than 20 minutes to get from the village to any of the venues. It also commended Tokyo's financial strength, which everyone probably knows about, but the Tokyo Metropolitan Government has set aside a reserve of $4.5 billion, which is pretty impressive. And that also combined with the strength of the Japanese economy is seen as pretty much green light for any infrastructure projects that are set to go ahead. And this was also mentioned, the infrastructure. Obviously, Japan already has exceptional public transport. That was something that was commented on in the report. No capital investment is required at all for accommodation, transport, airports. It's all there already. And it talked about Tokyo's existing very robust transport network.
This is Caleb Lauer in Istanbul. Up until last month, the conventional wisdom was that the Istanbul bid was, if not the clear forerunner, then at least the sentimental favorite. This is Istanbul's fifth try, and many people like the idea of the Olympics being held in a Muslim-majority country, in a city that is European, Asian, and Middle Eastern. Surveys have also shown that there is huge support for the bid among the local population, and the infrastructure investments are particularly impressive. Now, the conventional wisdom went out the window last month when protests and demonstrations erupted across the country. In particular, the very harsh police response to the protests in which people died and thousands were injured and which infringed on basic human rights of many Turks was assumed by many to have dealt a pretty serious blow to Istanbul's bid. Now, despite the personal tragedies, the protests are likely to have a very positive long-term effect on Istanbul and Turkey. Now, whether the protests themselves affect the decision to award Istanbul the Games, this remains to be seen. But if the city does win the bid, the 2020 Olympics will happen in what will likely be a much more democratic place, in great part because of the protests of June 2013.
I'm Liam Aldous, Monocle's Madrid correspondent, and I'm reporting from the sunny Spanish capital itself. So will it be a case of third time lucky for the Spanish capital? A successful bid would vindicate the hard and very expensive work of the Olympic Committee, but a loss would be embarrassing both internationally and locally, as there is growing disquiet amongst madrileños about the cost of the bid. There are some strong points to argue, though. 27 of the 36 required venues have already been built, and visitors will enjoy very short travel times to all of the venues. Madrid is also a very eclectic melting pot of all the Spanish cultures, and it will be a great opportunity to show off that diversity, something that was more difficult on Catalan territory during the Barcelona Olympics. However, the shadow of the Spanish economic crisis has undoubtedly been cast over the bid, and there's been strong scrutiny of the numbers, particularly at home. Organisers have also been quick to tout numbers showing that 75% of the city's residents support the bid. However, these figures were gathered at the end of 2011 and have been falling. So while the city council has been eager to colour the spending as an investment for the city, their dismal efforts to convince locals of the validity of the bid raise some questions about the quality of their communication strategy to the Olympic Committee. And watching Mayor Ana Botella's cringeworthy speech in broken English to the IOC delegation only a few months ago, one is forced to wonder whether there is any hope left.
Well, there you have it, Dominic. I don't know how you could not be excited with those candidate cities.
I mean, I'm weeping.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, extraordinary.
Well, that was our Monocle's Fiona Wilson in Tokyo, Caleb Lauer in Istanbul, and Liam Aldis in Madrid reporting for us from the cities hoping to host the 2020 Summer Olympics.
Well, it isn't only the candidate cities pitching to the IOC in Lausanne over the next few days, but there would be presidents of the organisation too. The incumbent, Jacques Rogge, steps down later this year after 12 years in the role. And to look at who might succeed him in the post and to assess Rogge's time as IOC president, I'm joined now by David Walashinsky, president of the International Society of Olympic Historians. David, welcome to Midori House. Thanks for joining us. So the International Society of Olympic Historians, that makes you the ISOH. I presume you're independent from the IOC then and can give us your opinion on the Olympic cities themselves, those three bid cities. Before we talk about Jacques Rogge, what do you make of the three options this time around in terms of the history?
We do actually receive funding from the IOC, but we're quite independent anyway, so we take that chance.
Okay.
The cities, it's a very interesting subject. I mean, it is kind of dramatic. I would have thought that Istanbul would have been the favorite until a few weeks ago, simply because the IOC members wanted to bring the Olympics to a new part of the world, to an Islamic country. Now, not so sure. In terms of the next president, in a way, that's more fascinating because it's a bigger story. You've just mentioned that Jacques Rogge was president for 12 years. There's no reason to believe that the next president would leave any sooner. The favorite is a man named Thomas Bach from Germany. He's set himself in a good position. Everybody knows him. But there are five other candidates. And it's very hard to predict because we don't know. They can give their speeches, as they will be doing this week, their presentations. But really, the real politicking is going on behind the scenes, one-on-one, in secret private meetings. And we really don't know what's going on there.
Absolutely. This election for the presidency of the IOC is a fascinating topic, and it's something that hasn't necessarily been covered that much by the world's media. But obviously, the presidency is the person who'll set the direction for the IOC over the next course of his term. How much influence will Jacques Rogge have in determining who will be his successor?
I would say very little. Just like anybody who's leaving a corporation or the head of an NGO, you can try all you want to keep your influence. But when those 100 or so members of the IOC sit down to vote, they're not going to really feel any allegiance to the lame duck president, the outgoing president. They're only going to think, what can I get out of the new president, to put it bluntly.
And David, I wonder, on what sort of terms do we judge those 12 years? It's been 12 years of, I guess, some controversy within that. But, you know, on what basis do you judge the success of that? Is it about, you know, how much the fight against doping is put forward? Or is it about the bidding process? How do you do it?
Well, there's many ways to do it. I think that, you know, certainly the previous president, Juan Antonio Samaranch, could easily be judged that, you know, he put the IOC on a good financial footing, and that he also democratized in an odd way the IOC, opening it up to a group of people beyond rich white men. With Jacques Rogge, it's harder to pin down. You can judge it by the finances, which seems to be pretty good. You can judge it by the doping. You can judge it by, you know, the fact that there haven't been any major boycotts, which is a good thing. But in the end, it's very hard to say what Roga's legacy will be at this point, as strange as that seems, even since he's been there for 12 years.
Well, I think at least he would argue that one of his legacies was his focus on youth and encouraging young people around the world to, you know, to join up to sport. Do you think his successor will focus that same energy on young people, or do you think the direction of the IOC and the Olympic movement perhaps would shift?
I think that when you talk about youth, it's nice to talk about these things, and it's great to get young people involved in sport, but they already are. And so what you're really talking about is trying to bring in the youth audience to television, to increase the revenues of the IOC by having younger people follow sports. And I think that one of the interesting issues that will happen for the next presidency will be the Olympic program. Do we really need dressage in the Olympics? The fact that they tried to just, the executive board just tried to get rid of wrestling, which is not only one of the original modern Olympic sports and ancient Olympic sports, but is actually included in the Olympic hymn. That was a rather bizarre turn of events, and we still don't know if wrestling will be reinstated. So I think reevaluating the Olympic program might be one of the main factors that the next president will be judged by.
And you did touch upon encouraging television audiences around the world. An interesting point, Thomas Bach, who you said was one of the front runners, he envisions an Olympic television network to sustain kind of interest levels between the games. How important do you think it is for the next president to come up with these money-creating ideas for the Olympics?
Again, full disclosure, my organization gets funding from the IOC, so sure, I'd like them to be financially viable. I think the idea of an Olympic network is an interesting one because there are a lot of sports that don't get covered between Olympics. But on the other hand, you have Eurosport, you have in the United States ESPN. There's an attempt to spread the interest in these sports, but the idea of the IOC getting involved is quite new because they've already always just given contracts out.
We're going to have to leave it there, David, but thanks very much for your perspective on that, and we will watch eagerly the next few days unfold. David Woloszynski is president of the International Society of Olympic Historians.
Dom, are you going to tell us who your pick is for the host city?
I'm afraid I wouldn't want to be seen to influence proceedings.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's a sealed bid as well.
Okay.
Right? Thanks very much.
We'll find out in September.
Just full disclosure, I take funding from the IOC.
Good for you.
Need to be quite careful.
In just a moment, we'll be setting the day's news agenda with Monocle's Thomas Lewis. We'll be right back.
For centuries, Sulaymaniyah has been a magnet for artists. On assignment in northern Iraq, Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, met with would-be hip-hop artists, painters and poets to discover the city's new creative wave.
Kurdistan exists, and yet it doesn't. It's a country, and yet it isn't. It has a soul, though, and a culture, and that's a start. And if that soul, that culture, is to be found anywhere, it is found here in Sulaymaniyah, a city of more than a million in the northeast of Iraq.
The Soul of Sulaymaniyah, a photographic essay on Monocle.com.
You are listening to Midori House. We are live from Studio One here in London. It's time to set the day's agenda. Three big stories you need to know about. Helping us do that is Monocle's producer, Thomas Lewis. Tom, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Dominic. Pleasure to be with you, but two
it's
gentlemen
nice to see
today.
You behind the glass. You're so versatile.
I mean, it's a brave new world for us all today.
Yeah, do you want to throw your hat in the ring, by the way, for the Olympic rings?
Well, I'm not wearing a hat today, so I'll probably keep my mouth shut, actually, on that
one. No
seeing
one's
as
drawn.
Everyone's been sitting on the fence this morning,
so I think there's no reason
a brave man than I will have to step forward, I'd say.
Okay. Tom, then, your three stories. Where do you want to start today?
Well, we'll start in Egypt, obviously, which is obviously one of the big stories that's still dominating the headlines around the world. These protests show no sign of abating, and the deadline that Egypt's military set, Mohamed Morsi, is fast approaching, I think, as we speak. week. It's about 8 hours away. Last night, President Morsi gave a very lively, very impassioned speech on national television, telling the Egyptian people that he was the country's legitimate ruler. He didn't really go as far as to condemn, I don't think, the protesters, but he did say that he wanted them to act peacefully. Now, this comes as well as a document from the Egyptian army apparently was leaked, we think, by the military itself, which seems like a blueprint for the way forward, you know, as a government without Morsi as its head, which has obviously raised the stakes, really. And
so we can see the working there. We can see something is being planned.
We can, even though the military said on Tuesday they had no intention of causing a coup, of taking over power themselves. So we are in this very odd situation where both sides are just kind of towing the line enough to keep the cards in the other party's hand, I think it's fair to say. So when the deadline comes, I think it's fair to say the protesters will still be out in their tens, hundreds of thousands across the country, and we just have to see what happens, I think.
And I do find it fascinating, President Barack Obama phoned Morsi yesterday asking him to meet with opponents. The American role in this is fascinating, isn't it? Because they potentially could withdraw billions of dollars worth of aid.
I mean, it is a really difficult position for the USA, I'd say. Obviously, they give a lot of military aid and a lot of military funding, but the USA does not want to be the sponsor of a military coup in Egypt. And obviously, we look over since the year that Mohamed Morsi took office and the Egyptian transitional authority before him, that the USA and Egypt, the relationship really fractured quite substantially, I'd say. These NGOs in Cairo were raided, were called sort of foreign operatives, those kind of things. So this level of distrust, I think, between from the Egyptian side towards the Americans was really ramped up in a way we hadn't seen for a very long time. So I think it is interesting now that President Obama has felt that it is a useful, maybe even wise move to call the president, not maybe to put too much pressure on, but just to say, you know, we are supporting you, but also look, you have to take the responsibility and take things into your own hands as well in a reasonable way, I suppose.
Yeah, a really fine balance, I think, for lots of nations to be treading at the moment. Let's move to Bolivia then.
Well, this is the wild case of Edward Snowden. It is a story that keeps on giving, I think it's fair to
say. Absolutely. What's it given us today?
So what it's given us is the forced landing of the official aircraft of the president of Bolivia in the Austrian capital, Vienna. I mean, every country is quickly getting involved in this story. So the story was that obviously Edward Snowden had written to, I think, a list of 21 nations asking for asylum. Mm. A lot of those countries quickly closed their doors and said, no, thank you very much. But Bolivia kept its doors open, or so it seemed. President Evo Morales of Bolivia was in Moscow with for a meeting of leaders who are nations that export gas. And obviously Edward Snowden has been, it's believed, in one area of Moscow's airport. And then when the president left Moscow on his plane, these rumours started circulating that Edward Snowden was on board on the president's official aircraft. And the plane was scheduled to land in Portugal to refuel. The Portuguese got wind of this rumour, said, no, thank you, you can't land here, and it was forced to land in Austria. Now, the government in Bolivia has acted pretty furiously about this. They've said that their president is being held hostage by imperialism, I think is the quote, and it's really sort of, you know, ramped up the storm of this whole story even further.
I mean, it does make me wonder, you know, if, you know, a president of a nation is flying through the air on a jet, you would imagine that, say, he and his people knew exactly who was on that plane. Mm. And even if there were a rumour going around on in an airport down below that maybe Edward Snowden was aboard, they could probably comfortably say, it's all right, we know he's not aboard.
Well, I suppose it's a risky game, though. If you are a president like Evo Morales, who likes being the antagonist to, say, the United States, I think, that, you know, wants to sort of say, actually, we will do what we want, we won't be dictated to by you, then all of a sudden these things come back to bite you, and that you are suddenly kind of caught up in this story that you really haven't got that much control over. So we'll see where Evo Morales and Bolivia's rhetoric goes next, and we'll see whether it will open its doors to Edward Snowden.
And Thomas, very quickly, a third topic, women in politics?
Yes. So there's always, when women candidates, obviously there are a lot of women leaders around the world. Australia just lost its. Michelle Bachelet is looking set to contest an election in Chile. Angela Merkel is seeking re-election in this autumn. A study has just been published that looks at coverage in the media of women candidates and whether covering what they wear and their appearance is actually damaging, which is what women's interest groups and anti-sexist organisations says is the case. And now this study has found actually, yes, even if you do mention in positive ways, in a neutral way, what a woman is wearing, the respondents to their study said, actually, yes, it does make me think of a woman candidate differently as opposed to a man. Now, there's lots of commentary going around that actually this study was pretty skewed and that the examples of coverage of women's clothes in politics was pretty off-kilter, actually. So they're not really holding that much store in it and saying that actually, you know, journalists do cover kind of what male candidates wear as much as women candidates too. So we'll see. As these big elections where women are involved come up, it'll be interesting to keep that in mind.
Fascinating stuff. Thomas Lewis, thank you for setting the day's agenda for us here in the studio. Many thanks for coming on the programme.
Thank you for having me.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. The time is 10:26 in Beirut, it's 9:26 in Munich, and 8:26 here in London. No, I was not just electrocuted.
Wow, that scared the heck out of me.
That was a flickering neon light there, a sound that isn't music to the ears for most of us. It's a sound and a sight that evokes for many of us the seedier side of city life. It also conjures up, you might argue, the image of capitalism as its crassest and its most garish form. Anyone who spent even the most fleeting of moments in Las Vegas will know what I mean. But it wasn't always so.
I've never been to Vegas, I'm afraid. The neon light, though, invented in London in the 19th century, went from technological marvel, lighting up the bright new metropolises of the 20th century, to one of the defining images of the pop culture boom of the 1950s. Fast forward to today, and you're as likely to see an installation of neon lights at an art gallery as you are adorning the windows of a tattoo parlour or a Chinese takeaway.
Well, a new book, Flickering Light, A History of Neon, explores our cultural relationship with neon illumination, and its author, Christopher Ribat, joins us now on the line from Germany. Christopher, many thanks for joining us on the program. Set the stage for us for this book, Flickering Light.
Well, thanks for having me. Well, what got me interested is not so much the crass capitalism that you were talking about, but the fact that neon is really an organic product, if you will. You know, it's in the air that we breathe, but, you know, 0.00046% of the air we breathe is made of neon, and if you extract it, if you charge it electrically, it's gonna have that red, orangey glow that fascinates us so much. So there is something natural about neon, and also, you know, the neon signs, they're really a product of craftsmen. You know, they breathe they form the glass tubes with their own breath, and they shape them with their own hands. So there was something really old-fashioned, something organic about neon, and that got me started with this history.
I wonder, give us an idea of how it changed things. I mean, I imagine if they would have immediately popped up one night and we went from no neon signs to neon signs, the world would have changed pretty dramatically. It would have changed a lot for businesses, would have changed a lot for the way a metropolis functions at nighttime, wouldn't it?
If you just killed off neon, I guess, even though there's not, I mean, neon in the traditional sense, that there's not so much around anymore. It's really, most of what we see, what we think is neon, is really made of plastic. And, you know, the great neon enthusiasts, the lovers of neon, you know, they want their neon to be in glass tubes, in these, you know, fragile, elegant tubes. And that came up in the 1920s. And it's still with us today, but not so much anymore.
Well, do you think neon light has been having a bit of a renaissance lately? Like, I've noticed a lot more specialist kind of neon lights in high-end furniture and design stores around the world. Do you think there's a newfound love affair with neon?
Definitely, definitely. You know, I'm trying to argue in my book that neon declined over the years in the late 20th century. And the more I travel and the more I look at neon all over the world, all over Europe, the more I find myself proven wrong, you know, you go to places like Vienna or, you know, small towns in Belgium, and you find the most beautiful neon signs. So they're still with us.
I mean, what does it mean now? What's it a shorthand for?
Well, I guess to a lot of people, it means urban excitement. I mean, you can't really think of small town neon. Well, yeah, that works. But you know, urban excitement is what neon signifies. You can really think of neon in in rural places. I guess that wouldn't really work. So yeah, and also of course the red light districts. I mean, that's what neon also represents. So it's that, you know, that excitement, that flicker of, you know, walking through city streets at night, you know, going from place to place. That's kind of what neon is about.
Christopher, thank you very much. Your book with a very appropriately eye-catching, flickering cover, I'm sure, is available to fans of neon in bookshops at the moment. It's the author of Flickering Light, A History of Neon. Thanks very much for joining us, Christopher.
Now, in the next half hour of the programme, we'll be checking in with one of our correspondents around the world. We'll be leafing through this morning's North American front pages, and we'll also hear how one Finnish wine company has achieved the distinction of being snapped up by the country's state-run network of liquor stores.
Usually the problems come when people look at the colour or when people think that this is a wine you should just enjoy on its own when it's hot outside. That's not really the case. You got to be more open-minded than that, as usual, with wine and realise that these wines are excellent.
Before all of that, Paul Osborne's here with your news headlines.
With just hours to go now until a deadline and imposed by Egypt's military, Mohamed Morsi has insisted he is the country's legitimate ruler and he will give his life to protect Egypt's constitution. Mr. Morsi went on state TV later on Tuesday night. Later today, it's reported the armed forces will depose him unless he agrees to share power with his rivals. At least 16 people have been killed in an apparent US drone strike in Pakistan. Most of those killed in the attack in North Waziristan are believed to have been fighters for the militant Haqqani network. Bolivia has condemned what it's called a huge lie, which it says forced a plane carrying the country's president to be diverted. It's reported France and Portugal refused to allow Evo Morales' plane to pass through their airspace after it took off from Moscow. There were reports that the US whistleblower Edward Snowden was on board. Bolivia is one of more than 20 countries where Mr. Snowden has sought asylum. An earthquake in the Aceh province of Indonesia has killed at least 22 people and injured more than 200 others. Rescue workers are now struggling to reach the worst affected areas because of landslides. And three former executives of the Japanese firm Olympus have been given suspended prison sentences over an accounting scandal. They admitted falsifying accounts to cover up losses of $1.7 billion. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul. Paul will be back at the top of the hour with another check of the world news headlines. You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds.
Now for a preview of this week's edition of The Entrepreneurs, we head to Finland, a country with very strict alcohol laws. Any alcoholic drink stronger than 4.7% must be sold through Alko. That's Finland's state-run network of liquor stores. Alko was founded in 1932 following the end of Prohibition, and it still enjoys a monopoly on Finland's wine and spirit sectors. It's notoriously difficult for small wine producers and importers to get their bottles onto Alko's shelves.
I've got to say, that name is great, isn't it? Alko.
Genius.
It's just promoting you to drink.
Where did they come up with that? I'm afraid my Finnish isn't good enough to know if there is another nuance to that word.
We need Marcus Hippie down here.
Yeah, where is he?
Where is he when you
when
need him?
When you need him.
Yeah. But Saari Wines, a company based in Helsinki that imports wines from France, has just had its first bottle accepted by Alko's powers that be. Well, Monocle's Mark Bosworth went to sample the bouquet in question on our behalf.
Wine is the biggest selling alcoholic drink in Finland, with over 60 million litres being sold each year. Wines from Chile, Spain and South Africa dominate the aisles of Alko stores. And this is what gave Larry Sarri, a Frenchman of Corsican descent, the idea to set up a wine importing business.
When I was trying to get some wine from either Alko or when I went out to eat for dinner, I was surprised that I didn't see any of the wines which I knew so well, and I knew they were great wines. And I was really surprised not to see anything from Provence or anything from Corsica. That sort of made an impression on me, and I thought that, you know, someone should introduce these wines to the restaurants or even to Alko. And so at the end of 2011, Saari Wines and Spirits was born.
Beneath the cobbled streets of downtown Helsinki is one of the city's most famous wine cellars. Around 70 private wine enthusiasts store their collections down here, among the dark brown and red brick walls. And Sari Wines also uses it as a showroom. Well, Larry, Alko is now selling one of your wines. That signals a big moment for your company.
Yeah, absolutely. This is very important. Alko being the state monopoly, you get more volumes, and in this business, the margins are basically per bottle are not so huge. So you need to have the volume if you want to keep your business alive and well and healthy. A big part of our philosophy is about rosé wines. Rosé wines are not famous in Finland. They suffer from a bad reputation. Maybe it's because of the color. I don't know. So we're really trying to push that forward, and being in Alko is the best thing.
It's very interesting. You do mention some of these stereotypes about rosé in Finland. And it's interesting that Alko went for this Bandol rosé from Provence in France. How confident are you that you can help overcome these Finnish stereotypes to rosé?
I'm not too sure if we can do it, but that's the beauty of this challenge. We're very confident about these wines. Rosé is as much of a wine as any white wine or any red wine or any champagne. So usually the problems come when people look at the color or when people think that this is a wine you should just enjoy on its own when it's hot outside. That's not really the case. You got to be more open-minded than that, as usual, with wine and realize that these wines are excellent. They are really, really good, very versatile, very fresh. Obviously, I'm talking about rosés from Provence. They're very special. I think that in Provence, people should taste rosé. This is really what this region, the best wines you can find in Provence are rosés.
You talk about your company's philosophy. Mm-hmm. What is the philosophy?
Our philosophy is actually very simple. We believe that wine is like music. You have different styles of music. You've got the marketing around it. You've got the taste of the people. You've got different opinions. Different styles of wine, different winemakers, different lands, different grapes, etc., etc. So it all sounds really complex, but at the end of the day, it's not. When you're listening to a good piece of hard rock in the morning because you like hard rock, that's up to you. Maybe in the evening you'll be playing classical music, I don't know. Doesn't mean hard rock is better than classical or vice versa. So we believe in diversity in wine. At the same time, we like the originality of certain wines. So we believe a Chablis should taste like a Chablis and a champagne should taste like a champagne. We like this regional thing and that pushes us to actually be pioneers and discover new wines that nobody knows about.
It's not just the state-owned Alko that's recognizing Sari Wines' offerings. Many of Helsinki's leading fine dining restaurants now include them on their wine lists, such as Chef and Sommelier, a Michelin-recommended restaurant. Johan Borja is responsible for compiling the wine list here. So, Johan, why did you decide to stock these wines?
Sari Wines, they have a lot of interesting and small producers that we are looking to get on our wine card. We'll try to find these more personal and interesting and maybe a bit left-field wines that you don't maybe see everywhere. So we tend to work with small importers, small suppliers like Sari Wines.
Why is it important to you to go with these lesser-known importers and producers?
The reason why we work with them is not that they are small, but because they tend to have the more interesting producers and the more interesting wines in their portfolio. If you look at, for instance, Alko, the state-owned monopoly in Finland, they need very big volumes. They have a lot of stores and they sell everything in big quantities, so small producers for them are quite difficult.
And how popular are the wines from Sari Wines proving to be here at Chef and Sommelier?
People have liked them very much. People come here with an open mind and they expect wines that are maybe a bit away from the mainstream.
Cheers, Larry.
Cheers.
Cheers, Dom.
Cheers. I've got nothing to clink. And I think it's a bit early. It's only 8:40. You've really got to keep your drinking under control. Was Monocle's Mark Bosworth on Sari Wines for this week's edition of The Entrepreneurs. And you can hear Mark's report in full and many more on entrepreneurship around the world on the latest installment of The Entrepreneurs. And that airs later today, 1900 hours London time.
You think I found it?
Very good.
Two glasses.
That's it. Always with a couple of glasses in his back pocket. That is Mr. Phil Hahn.
Well, you are listening to Majority House. We'll be heading to Paris right after this very short break.
Section D is the show you listen to for the untold stories, secrets, and blazing headlines in the design sphere. The architects, fashion followers, artists, and engineers who are making and breaking the trends across the world.
When Valentino touches the clothes, you see his hands tracing those lines of shape, form, and to see Valentino arranging one of his dresses is to understand the dress in terms of structure.
Join me, Hugo MacDonald, for an hour of insight, interviews, and discussion every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24. The Globalist Asia is our brand new show covering global stories, but with a focus on what's shaping the business day from Beijing to Bangkok, Singapore to Sydney.
My vision of the Japan, how I see with this, is, I mean, I grew up in Paris, but that's how I see Japan.
There are also fresh insights from our global network of correspondents, contributors and editors, including a survey of the Asian front pages.
We're going to disagree to disagree, and we're just going to keep doing it and doing it and doing it, and no one really has a playbook for how this turns out at all.
So tune in to The Globalist Asia every weekday for your global news digest. That's The Globalist Asia at 3 a.m. in Hong Kong, 4 a.m. in Tokyo, and 6 a.m. in Sydney. Brought to you in association with GE.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 9:41 in Paris. It's 8:41 here in London, but it is to France where we're going to head to next for our daily check-in with one of our Monocle correspondents around the world. Joining us on the line from Paris is our correspondent there, Tom Burgess Watson. Tom, welcome to the program. Tom, let's begin with Snowden. He's causing some more tension, isn't he?
Good morning to you both. He certainly is. Those reports in Der Spiegel magazine sent shockwaves right through Europe, and the allegations in those reports that the United States had been spying on France, amongst other European countries, provoked a very angry reaction from our president here, President Hollande, actually the strongest reaction so far by a European leader who said he blasted the United States and said, we absolutely can't accept this kind of behavior. You know, the United States is supposed to be our partner and our allies, absolute fury. And the French government summoned the American ambassador to come and explain what was going on, and Hollande also threatening that if that espionage doesn't come to an immediate stop, talks which are underway at the moment between the European Union and the United States on a free trade agreement could very well find themselves going no further. But there are some saying that France is being rather hypocritical here, because France, after all, is known as being one of the world's top snoopers. It's right up there with Russia and Israel, according to the U.S. magazine Foreign Policy, and they're leading this week with a story entitled French Hypocrisy, Espionnage Moi, it says on its front page, and it says that Air France in the 1990s typically bugged the seats of business leaders to find out secrets. But it's been quite a week for fiery rhetoric between Paris and Washington, and the best bit, as far as I was concerned, was when Barack Obama said that if he wants to know what's going on in France, he'll pick up the phone and he'll speak to President Hollande, he said, and that caused lots of amusement here in France. Because, of course, he's not called President Hollande, he's called President Hollande.
The British Chancellor, Geoffrey Osborne, could probably tell him exactly how to pronounce it as well. I wonder, Tom, with such a hardline reaction, it makes one wonder what sort of political capital there is at stake here, and what sort of moves Hollande may or may not be making.
Yes, well, I think President Hollande is probably rather rather livid. I think he's certainly tried to talk tough. I mean, I don't think anyone really knows for sure, you know, who's bugging who and who's you know, is this really a case of the pot calling the kettle black? But certainly here in France, it's provoked lots of debate. On the far left, politicians were saying that actually France should provide asylum to Snowden, and so did the far right. Marine Le Pen, the far right leader, also saying that France should give asylum to this brave young man, she called him. So it's an extraordinary debate. I don't think anyone really knows the extent of the espionage operations, and indeed whether or not France is being slightly hypocritical here.
And you mentioned Le Pen there. She's in a bit of trouble, though, perhaps.
Perhaps. Brussels voted yesterday 44-1 for her to have her immunity lifted. She's currently immune, well, she was until now immune from prosecution as an MEP. But the far-right leader now finds herself on track to be prosecuted for inciting racial hatred. Now, this dates back 3 years. She gave a speech in Lyon in which she said that Muslims praying in the streets of France, which in fact they're no longer allowed to do, was comparable to the Nazi occupation. Now, this is very strong language and very provocative as a remark. She said, you know, there are more and more burqas in this country. This is occupation. Some people here in France saying that, in fact, the idea that praying in the streets was banned just a year after she made those comments means that perhaps she had a point. And Le Pen saying, you know, I dared to say what the French people just think. But, you know, she could face prosecution if sentenced. She could get a one-year sentence in jail. Most people saying that's very unlikely. She's hugely popular here. In the last election, she got 18% of the vote, and last week she secured a strong win, 46% of the vote in a by-election. So I don't think she's particularly worried. And in any case, her father himself made fairly inflammatory comments, and he also found himself falling foul of the European Parliament. So let's see what happens. But I don't think anyone's particularly worried, least of all Marine Le Pen.
Okay, well, some question marks at least over what may or may not be happening to Marine Le Pen. But President Hollande has just sacked another minister. No question marks there. What's happened?
Yes, this young minister, Delphine Bateau, who is the ecology minister, I suppose the environment minister more correctly in English, she gave a radio interview yesterday in which she criticised the budget cuts that her department had received. She was told to come up with 7% cuts in her budget for her ministry, and she went on the radio and she said, "This is a bad budget." Those were her exact words, a bad budget. And very shortly afterwards, she was summoned to see the Prime Minister, and within 30 minutes of that meeting starting, a statement had been released saying she'd been sacked and replaced. And you know, people quite surprised by this. There's quite a lot of sympathy for Delphine Bateau. The newspapers this morning, it's absolutely the front page story. And on the whole, the left wing press fairly predictably supportive of her, saying she's right to speak up because France is right now having to deliver its first government spending cut since 1958. So this is really not in the spirit of French government up until now, cutting back budgets. But France has got to do this. France has to reduce its budget deficit to 3.9% of its GDP this year. So a sort of realization that perhaps François Hollande is getting tough, because she is the first minister to get the axe since he came to power just over a year ago.
And Tom, finally, the Tour de France has gotten off to a bit of a chaotic start.
Yes. If anyone tuned in to watch the Tour de France the weekend, they would probably be quite surprised, because there was a bus that got wedged right under the finish line. I mean, I can only suggest people YouTube this one. One of the team buses went under the finish line, but got stuck because it was too tall, and it got wedged in there, and then it broke down. And the result was the cyclists were all coming hurtling towards the finish line at very high speed, as they do at 40 miles an hour. And this caused a tailback and a pile-up of cyclists who were all going at high speed, and they had to change the finish line. And this is supposed to be the Tour de France where everyone's saying, okay, there's a new start for the race, no more doping, there's been so much cheating, and the race is being held in Corsica for the first time ever. It's the 100th edition of the Tour de France, and it's a huge event, in not just in France. I mean, it's the biggest sporting event in the calendar here in France. But it's also the third most watched TV sporting event on Earth after the World Cup and the Olympics. So it's a hugely popular sport. I'm personally not a great fan of cycling, but it is quite telegenic as a race, this one. It's, you know, going through some quite beautiful areas of French soil, and basically the whole of France is glued to their televisions till the 21st of July when that comes to an end. And it's going to have a spectacular finish because they're going to cross the finish line on the Champs-Élysées at night, which has never been done before. So even if you don't like cycling, some quite interesting bits of television in the making.
Excellent stuff, Tom. We're going to have to leave it there. Monocle's Paris correspondent Tom Burgess Watson, many thanks for your time.
And we will stay in France for our musical interlude on today's Midori House. This is Philippe Catherine with Paris Vélib.
Devant le Louvre, la pyramide du Louvre, et on se dira que le Louvre essaie de faire peur à la pyramide, alors que c'est la pyramide qui fait peur au Louvre. La pyramide ne se reflète pas dans le Louvre, alors que le Louvre se reflète dans la pyramide. Personne veut se voir tout le temps dans un miroir. Non.
Wow, that was the intimate end of Philippe Catherine's song Paris Vélib. You're listening to Midori House. We are here on Monocle 24. I'm Dominic Reynolds, and Phil Hahn is here too.
And welcome back. You are listening to Midori House. We have the pleasure of having Monocle's Danny Jacopelli in the studio. He's going to review this morning's North American front pages. Welcome to the program, Danny.
Good to be here. Good morning.
Good morning.
Lovely rainy London morning.
Yeah. Danny, exactly where in the States are you from? Give us geo spot you on the map. Where are you?
Specifically, Ithaca yes. Street.
although I've gone on to street level viewing
Google,
of Ithaca Street.
Google Earth.
34 well. Ithaca.
No, calm down.
fans want to go.
No, it's Long Island, New York.
Okay. Direct from Long Island. We have a conspiracy theory to start us off. What's going on?
Yeah, we do. So I'm sure many people remember back in 1996, a 747 blowing up, TWA Flight 800. 230 people, everybody on board died. And it was one of the really big first kind of aviation incidents where the world was watching. You know, the internet was starting up, lots of conspiracy theories were being thrown around. And at the time, they blamed it on a spark in a gas tank. But now, and that was the official kind of ruling that the National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB, came up with. But now a new documentary is saying, well, you know what, maybe it wasn't, maybe it was something from an external explosion, like a missile, which is what some people said at the time, obviously.
And this has been going on for kind of 17 years, these conspiracy theorists saying it was a missile. But the NTSB obviously categorically denying that. They have the official report saying it indeed was not a missile.
They did.
And I've seen several documentaries recently where they actually said...
I knew you watched this sort of thing.
Well, there was a... They did this TWA Flight 800 documentary on CNN back in America, I think it was about 3 weeks ago, where they looked at this very topic and they said it definitely was not a missile. So how much credence should we be giving to this new documentary?
Well, some of the people working on this documentary are actually former members of the NTSB. Who have said, you know what, actually the NTSB didn't take all of the proper precautions, the proper protocols when they were investigating the incident. They said there's some suspicious kind of things going on here. Obviously the NTSB says, no, that's completely inaccurate. But, you know, you never know. One of the main pieces of, if you could call it evidence, was that a lot of bystanders on the ground when it happened said there was big streaks of white light going straight towards the plane. And a number of people, unconnected people, said they saw this. You know, the NTSB people blame that on pieces of debris falling from the plane.
Okay. So it's exactly the sort of thing, in fact, that Oliver Stone might make a movie about. But before he does that, he's got something else on the slate.
Yeah, so Oliver Stone made a movie. He did make a movie about his old friend, Hugo Chavez, you know, deceased president of Venezuela, and now he's coming up with a new kind of postscript to Hugo Chavez's life. Nobody really knows what it's going to be. It seems like he's using footage from his documentary and also after his death. But he's announced that, and he's also come out and said unrelatedly that he's trying to help Edward Snowden get asylum in Ecuador.
And an interesting story here out of the Washington Post. Everyone's favorite Republican, the Texas governor, Rick Perry, he's got some exciting future plans he's going to announce. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, God help us all. Well, people are waiting. He announced that he's going to send, going to make a big announcement on this upcoming Monday. People think he's going to announce another shot at the top office. He ran for president and he failed miserably. if you all remember, he's kind of a, you know, the caricature of an American cowboy, kind of Bush, you know, times five. So we shall see what he's going to do there.
Well, I will be watching with interest, and I look forward to any debate that he takes part in the future. We could have labelled that under fun and quirky, but with sort of respect to Rick Perry, we didn't. However, there are plenty of other stories under the fun and quirky title. The first from the New York Times.
Yeah, I guess you could call this fun and quirky. I at least do. Former Tiffany's executive, Tiffany the jewelry company, apparently stole 165 pieces of their very expensive jewelry over, it seems, the course of only a year, and was selling them to a Manhattan jewelry dealer and made a $1.3 million.
Wow.
Thinking, I guess, that nobody would notice.
Of course not. It's only 165 pieces of jewelry?
Yeah, you know, nobody keeps count of that kind of
well,
stuff.
I'm surprised she was able to get up to 165 pieces of
jewelry. Exactly.
Yeah, I've stolen 170 pens from this place in the last year. That's a joke. A
couple microwaves.
Yeah. So. Better watch out. New York City, it's finally getting its own domain name as well.
Yeah, so now if you want to register philhon.nyc.com, which I'm sure many people now listening will run out and do.
don't steal it, please.
Please do.
You can. You know, it's a good way for business. Businesses and brands to kind of have that New York City brand. And finally, before we go, really quickly, someone found Steve Martin's wallet on a street and returned it. There you go. Washington
glorious.
Post.
Danny Giacopelli, always cheering up our mornings with the North American front pages. Many thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you.
And that is all we have time for on today's show. Thomas Lewis was the producer of this show. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and by Tess McCann too. Chris Fitch was the man in charge of the studio.
Up next after the news is The Menu with Marcus Hippie. Dominic and myself will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Dominic Reynolds. Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.